Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 433rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of Program and Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta.
And you know what, Mike? There just really aren't enough diabetes studies.
No, there's never enough, James, or subgroups. But I'm feeling that's about to change.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little sweet today. So,
Sure. Well, then what have you done with James?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Oh, hey, words hurt.
We had a talk about hurting with our words.
We did, and you obviously ignored it. So. So we're going to do a diabetes roundup, and I think that's, you know, we're going to go through three or four or five trials that have come out recently that do help answer questions a little bit. And I don't think we've done any of these studies previously. If we have, you wouldn't have remembered, you won't remember anyway. So we're just going to run through some new ones that have come out and try to put them into perspective. So why don't you start us off, Mike?
Yeah, so let's start, and we call it a roundup because James and I are both living in the West, so it's that. I hope you edit that out.
No, I'm not editing that in.
Okay, let's start with dapagliflozin. So, the gliflozins, which are like EMPA and CANA and all that stuff, they had two relatively large trials come out, and Dabby will talk about. In two different ways, but let's start with the idea of it as a diabetes drug. So there were 17,000 people studied, this was 10 milligrams versus placebo for just over 4 years. The mean age of the patients was 64, 62% were men. Oh, I'm going to do great today. A1C was 8.3 and past cardiovascular disease was 41%. So what did they achieve in the end? Well, A1C was on average 0.4% less. In all of these studies, we're going to give you the overall A1C or the end A1C. But just to let you know that when these trials start and they start these new drugs, the A1C differences are slightly better than that. They're not at 1%, but they're a little bit better than the number we present. But then over time, of course, they get closer to together again. So this was 0.4% overall.
You see that in other clinical trials, although, you know, typically in clinical trials, what happens, you still see the separation, but on average, A1C goes up in both groups over time.
Right. And so there's this right at the beginning, there's this great separation and it's true in cholesterol studies, BP studies. And then that difference becomes a little less over time. It's not gone. It's just a little less. BP was almost 3-1 better in the dabigaflozin treatment. And that's not really what we care about as much as things like cardiovascular disease. So cardiovascular disease went down 7%, which was not statistically significant and probably not clinically meaningful either.
And that's a relative difference.
Yeah. And death was the same thing. Again, not statistically significant or likely clinically meaningful. If you want the absolute differences, it was 9.4% versus 8.8%. So that's 0.6% difference over 4 years. And 6.6 versus 6.2 for mortality. So almost 0.5%. Over 4 years, so 0.1% per year in these kind of moderate risk patients who are kind of about 50% had, or half of them had, almost half of them had past cardiovascular disease. So renal outcomes, they were a bit tricky in this. They pooled renal death and end-stage renal disease with a decline in GFR of 40% or more. That's an important decline, but it's still a surrogate decline. And so that difference was a hazard ratio of almost 50%. So that's good. But how much of it was the surrogate marker? Most of it was. The actual differences were about 2.8% versus 1.5%. Number needed to treat 77.
And this is one of the few studies that actually has an impact on renal outcomes.
Right. And we're seeing that more with the Gleflozins, and we'll get to the big Gleflozin, Canagliflozin study, which I think was more impressive. But still something positive, although most of it's in the surrogate marker still.
Yeah, because what's important, because you know, I think people might have a mistaken perception that these drugs have all, you know, they've all been shown to have an impact and so on. But when you look at like things like end-stage renal disease or, you know, clearly important renal outcomes, very few of these have had any impact.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite something.
And that is absolutely true. And really we're talking about, when you're talking about proving that you can reduce renal death or dialysis or that kind of thing, you're talking about the Steno trial. That's really it. And so that was multiple interventions over a long period of time, including more exercise and all that stuff. And so there was lots of things that were done to that group to reduce that risk. And they were high risk patients. But we'll get canagliflozin in the gliflozins was the one that really accomplished this. But the other thing that they found in the dabigatran study was that heart failure was reduced about heart failure hospitalizations was reduced about 30%. And what's interesting is these patients weren't really at risk for heart failure. Certainly not patients known to have heart failure. And so the bad outcomes were diabetic ketoacidosis was slightly increased by about 0.2%, and genital infections were up by almost 1%. So some harms, not much benefits except a little bit in renal disease and a little bit in heart failure. So that kind of led, I think.
And I was going to add though, and what one doesn't know is if we even care, is it based on the glucose changes or the blood pressure changes or a bit of both or neither?
I don't care.
No, I know.
You've purchased it lots. It's interesting to hypothesize why that could be and imagine a mechanism, but I'm not sure. If you look at the FDA and NICE and others, they have suggested that you need a minimum of 0.5 of A1C change to make a difference. That's based on So I don't know, and that blood pressure change of 2.7 or 3 millimeters of mercury, I'm not sure if that's enough. So what's doing it, I'm not quite sure, but it's not doing a lot anyway. The bigger is that Dabby was someone kind of figured out that this was maybe a better heart failure drug, and so they performed a separate analysis, not of this trial, but on a separate group of people with heart failure. And this was 4,744 heart failure patients, with most were class 2, two-thirds, and then one-third was class 3. These were almost all on maximum therapy. 40% of them were diabetic. And after only 1.5 years, now remember the other trial in diabetes went for almost three times that. But after only 1.5 years, heart failure hospitalization and cardiovascular death went from 21% in the placebo arm down to 16%. Number needed to treat 21 over 1.5 years. And death from any cause went from 14% down to 12%. Number needed to treat there is 44. And again, over only 1.5 years. So
that's not dissimilar to what we have seen with other heart failure treatments. It might be a little bit less, but it's getting there in that regard.
Oh, for sure. And these are class 2 and 3, and it's only 1.5 years. I think these numbers are very similar. And if you were a medical science type person, James, and I'm not suggesting that either of us are, but if you were, you might think of dabigatran more effectively as a heart failure medicine than a diabetes medicine.
Yeah. So just add that to the other 7 you have people on. As we talked about in our previous. We talked about this in our heart failure podcast that we did last time. So we've gone over this heart failure trial before, but it's just putting it in the context of diabetes.
Yeah, and that this drug was originally designed as a diabetes drug, and yet in my eyes anyway, it's much more effective as a heart failure medicine. Yeah. Anyhow, let's move on to number three trial. And that second one was not really a diabetes trial, but
right.
It was with a diabetes drug. Let's get on to the cannabis.
But it is 40% were diabetic.
Yeah. But let's talk about canagliflozin, because James, this one came up. This one was published in this year, but it was published a number of months ago. And I remember you saying to me, "This is a landmark trial," and I said, "We're not talking about it."
it's hard to believe we were at the opposite spectrums of anything.
I know, hard to believe. But here it is. It's come around now once we piled on all these diabetes studies. And this one was 4,400 patients. And these patients had a GFR between 30 and 90. And they were these were all renal patients. So the GFR was one of the ways to get in. But the bigger way was through the albumin-creatinine ratio and albuminuria. And so they had a minimum of 30 milligrams per millimole, or if you prefer the other units, 300 milligrams per gram.
Right.
So these guys had, and they were protein spillers for sure. That was one of the main ways to get into this study. So these are patients who, on top of being diabetic, are showing deterioration in their renal function. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important for who's enrolled, because they did find some pretty important things. And we know that, a risk factor for worsening risk of heart disease is deteriorating renal function.
Yeah.
This was canagliflozin 100 milligrams once a day versus placebo, followed for 2.6 years. Again, very similar to the other ones they're all going to look the same. Mean age is 63, 66% male, A1C 8.3, GFR was 56 on average, and the mean albumin-creatinine ratio was 927 when you're looking at that milligrams per gram. Mm-hmm. So that would be 90 or so if you're looking at milligrams per millimole. So these people really had important renal disease. Their A1C went down 0.3, and their blood pressure went down 3/1 again or so.
Yeah, I was going to say that those relatively small changes, you actually can't pick those up with lab tests.
No.
and blood pressure measurements. So, you can when you study, 4,000 in this study or 17,000 in the other study, but you literally can't pick it up on an individual patient and go, "Oh, this drug did that in my patient." So it's really interesting in that, if you were to use these medications, there really isn't any need to, you're not looking for the surrogate marker changes.
Yeah. And it would be, like you said, it's not impossible to pick up. Certainly early in the trial, like when you would first start it, you would see a bigger difference there.
Yeah, but even you know, the variation in these tests, I mean,
I know.
Yeah, it is really, all I'm saying is that is not your, that is not the marker you need to be measuring for success.
Yeah, no. I agree with you. But if you were to measure it, you're more likely to see a tiny change down than you are to see a tiny change up or stability. But you're absolutely right. Yeah. When you see that, the it started out at 8 and now it's at 7.6, you don't know if that's variance or the change.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't know, but but we're dreamers in medicine, so we imagine that what we did had an effect. Okay, so let's get on to the outcomes. Renal death, dialysis, and transplant. So a little bit different. These are very serious renal outcomes, I would say.
I would say, yeah.
And the hazards ratio was 0.72. That means about a 30% relative reduction in these events. So not quite one third, but over a quarter shave off from 4.8% risk down to 3.5. So little over 1% reduction, number needed to treat 77. So this is important, because we had mentioned earlier already that Steno was the only one to date that showed a reduction in these serious
renal endpoints. Yeah.
Yeah. And so very important to recognize that this is doing it. If you pooled it with doubling of creatinine, the hazard ratio becomes 0.66. So it's about a third reduction, goes from around 10 down to around 7, number needed to treat 31. And the other outcomes were looking good too. Cardiovascular disease was down by 20% from 12 to 10. Number needed to treat 44, and death was down by 17%. That wasn't relative. That wasn't statistically significant. It went from 9 or so to about 7.5.
But at least, what we do, and what, you know, people who've listened to the podcast, when you, if it's not statistically significant, but you have other things that are, you at least look at it and go, oh, at least it's going in the right direction.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's, so we can say, and we know that in other trials, canagliflozin has reduced death, and or EMPA has, class. Yeah. So it's very reassuring. And then what was interesting in Canada, as you know, with the first big trial we looked at from New England, we worried about amputations being higher, and that wasn't borne out in this study. So, and we mentioned it even then, there was a chance that that result was spurious because so many outcomes were being tested. And so it's looking like you don't need to worry about increased amputations. Diabetic ketoacidosis was up by about 0.5%, number needed to harm there of about 225. So really, James, I think, you know, and I hate to say that you may have been right, but this is a bit of a landmark study in showing that for patients with renal disease, you can actually reduce their progression to the relatively infrequent, hard renal endpoints of renal death, dialysis, and transplant.
Yeah. And I think the fact that and you know, whether it's not, it's a landmark trial, I think is clearly debatable because I don't even like those words. But it's an interesting thing that, you know, when we see when we see a 1.2% benefit, I mean, I think the public would be shocked if we said that was landmark.
Well, yeah, you know, it's landmark in that it found something.
Yeah, exactly. Because we've had so many failures.
This is, we literally, you know, for all of the talk about, I go to a lot of conferences, as you know, and I know you do too. And how many conferences are we at where we're taught to watch out for kidney disease and diabetes is the number one causer to, and all of this stuff about we have to be so aggressive, and yet we so rarely hear of actual benefits. It's so rare that we actually see it. So I would suspect, James, that this, like in the first presentation of empagliflozin, it wouldn't surprise me if this got a standing ovation from nephrologists.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's more a standing ovation for relief. Thank goodness we're not hurting people.
That's it. Well, and it's also like, you know, you're doing your best to take care of people. You've been trying to find things that actually help, and to finally be told that this actually helps patients in those hard renal endpoints. It's a bit of a landmark, not in the amount of benefits. It's in a landmark that it showed something.
And when that's what I mean. And when you say it helps patients, you mean the 1 in 77.
Yeah. You,
I'm taking over your role as being, you know, sort of Mr. Negative.
In the peer group, I always joke that I'm the one with sunshine.
Oh God, that's sad. Why don't we keep going?
Okay, yeah, let's keep going. We got two more trials.
Yeah.
The next two are from the other area, GLP-1s. So as we've spoken about with the gliflozins, they're the SGLT2s. This is the GLP-1s. They're the ones that generally required injection. But we'll look at two studies here. Dulaglutide is the first we'll talk about. It had just shy of 10,000 patients, 9,900 diabetics, randomized to 1.5 milligrams sub-Q per week, once a week. Mm-hmm. Followed for 5 years. And these were patients who weren't really high risk, or certainly not as high risk as the others. They were 7% A1C. Their age was 66, 50% male. Only 21% had cardiovascular disease history. So this should help address some of the concerns that we hear a lot of the time, that they're only proven to work in patients with cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. That's been one of the arguments that we hear. And so this one was brave enough to try and study patients who didn't have that. So what did they find? A1C was down 0.6%, weight was down 1.5 kilos, and BP was down 1.7 over 0.5. So again, these are small surrogate marker changes. Cardiovascular disease was 0.88 was the hazard ratio. That means a 12% reduction. And in real numbers, that means going from about 13.5 down to 12%. So the number needed to treat there is 72. All-cause mortality was down by about 10%, but not statistically significant. What does that look like in real numbers? It's 12 to 11. Microvascular disease had lots of surrogates in there, particularly microalbuminuria and GFR decline of 30% or more. And it went from around 21.5 down to about 18.5. So that's about 3%. Again, though, that was filled with surrogate markers that were driving that outcome. So not nearly as impressive as the last one. Discontinuation due to adverse events was 9% versus 6%. So again, we know this from the GLP-1s, they're a bit harder to tolerate because of their GI distress. And how much does that contribute to the weight loss with them? Not sure. There's some concern that the subgroups like the in the US and Canada, they didn't see the same benefit from the GLP-1s as places like Europe and the rest of the world did. So just a caveat to keep in mind.
They're not powered to look for differences, you know, between different places and so on. And again, just like with the when we talked about the amputation issues with some of the other medications, you know, this could just be a spurious finding.
Yeah, exactly. But anyhow, an interesting result done in a different population, lower risk, that found benefits. They're small. The benefits are small, but they're headed in the right way. And as you kind of joked about earlier, James, like a lot of them with Rosie and sulfonylureas and things like that, you're wondering, is this harming people?
Yeah.
at least this time we can say it looks like this might help a little bit.
Yeah.
And as you said,
how sad is that? Yeah.
Geez, I do have to be the cheery
you
one.
You do, yeah. It's okay. Sad. But it, you know, it does explain the dress and the pom poms that you're wearing. If this was a video one podcast, you'd see it. It's quite something.
Yeah, I am cheering here. So, the other one, which I think is very interesting in this arena, is oral semaglutide. Mm-hmm. So, in the case of the glutides, you know, we just mentioned their injections. People generally want to avoid that, and so the glutides have been restricted somewhat in their uptake because they've certainly been pushed by our endocrinology colleagues, I would say, but many of us know our patients aren't excited about taking injections because
I don't think anybody is.
No, but if they can switch these to oral, that would be
wonderful.
And so we have oral semaglutide for diabetes. This was 3,183 patients. Given 14 milligram per day, so that's a much higher dose than what you do with injections, but that's because of the absorption process as the dose is being worn down. And this was just under 1.5 years, so 16 months. Mean age was 66, males 68%, A1C 8.2, and CVD or chronic kidney disease 85%. So when you're looking at these, you're seeing patients very, very similar a lot of the time, the kind that are being studied. So what did we get to? Well, A1C was reduced 0.7 here, which is more than what we've seen previously, and weight was down almost 3.5 kilos. Not much difference in blood pressure. Cardiovascular disease hazard ratio was 0.79, so that's a 20% relative reduction, which didn't reach statistical significance. Most of the effect in there came from cardiovascular disease death, and that went, the hazard ratio there was 0.49, or a 50% reduction, which was statistically significant. And overall mortality was also down around 50% again. And the numbers there, if you want the exact numbers, they're 2.8% versus 1.4% number needed to treat 72. Discontinuations were up 12% versus 7. Number needed to harm is 20. And again, mostly, as you'd expect, GI related.
Yeah.
So, you know, these drugs, I think the idea of switching it to oral is a good idea. I think they're probably, they were, as an injection, they were hard to tolerate on the stomach. And so now taking them orally just likely makes that a little bit worse. But still, I think patients will prefer oral versions of these over the injections. And so we'll have to see. This is not yet available in Canada, the last time I checked, but available in the United States as of September this year.
And all of these are, almost all of these are being published in like the New England Journal of Medicine. So these are getting major play out there. And so that's why we sort of thought it was important to at least put a synopsis of these studies together and put it into context. And so that's the sort of feature that we're trying to present to you with just running through these quick trials. But it's a fairly consistent finding for all of these.
It is a relative, DABI had the least effectiveness, I would say, but they're either reducing heart disease or death or both, and they're doing it by a little bit each time, kind of a 15 to 20% relative reduction overall, whatever your baseline risk is. And that's being found whether you're studying it in primary prevention mostly or secondary prevention mostly.
I would say that the evidence is much more solid in secondary prevention.
It is much more solid, but what I'm suggesting is the idea that it only works in secondary prevention. It's again an extrapolation that we saw earlier with the statin studies, because that's where the research was done, and so everyone assumed, well, they only work in secondary, and it all depends on how you define work, because these studies, all you need to do is study enough people for longer, and I remember Scott taking the peer group through a lesson in the event rates expected and doing an analysis on that. And he had really done some interesting stuff about how, because many of the drugs now are only finding a 15% reduction, we needed much bigger studies for longer to accumulate the events necessary to show differences in these small differences that we're seeing now.
But the only reason I'm saying that is it was interesting. One of the first canagliflozin trials that came out, it was called Canvas, and that study looked at both people with primary and secondary prevention, and the overwhelming news report or the overall commentary about it was this drug is clearly being shown to now work in both primary and secondary, because when they had this weird statistical manipulation of it. But it was really interesting, because when you look at it, it clearly had an effect in secondary prevention. And if you actually looked at the hazards ratio for the primary prevention group, it was 0.98. It had nothing. And here's the statistical manipulation. They said that they couldn't show that secondary was better than primary. So therefore, primary must be as good as second. It's some of the, we have, the abbreviation of a podcast is BS. This was incredible BS.
It was a huge extrapolation.
It just, they literally made it up.
They didn't. They use statistics to their advantage, and you can do that. I've done studies where we don't find a difference, and then we switch to a fixed effects or random effects model, or we switch to an odds ratio versus, and you can show what you want.
Yeah.
Most of the time, ethics get in the way. If you can abandon those, statistics can be a good friend.
Yeah, but it was even worse than just that thing, because this is the line they use. I'm just going to quote: "Canagliflozin reduced cardiovascular outcomes with no statistical evidence of heterogeneity of the treatment effect across the primary and secondary prevention groups." They are trying to say that the study wasn't powered to show difference between those groups, but because it didn't, therefore they must be the same.
You can say that if your P is 0.06, James.
Oh, I know. It drives me.
That's
nuts.
The thing, right? I know, but it's not being dishonest. It's just using, dishonest.
There's a difference between, this is being just, it's not dishonest. It's being incredibly manipulative.
Jeez, this is a different side of you.
I know. That one just kind of bugged me, but anyway. I mean, I know you basically put, all your diabetics on 17 drugs and they love you.
I do. Max dose, first visit.
Yeah. And
I see your A1C is 6.8. So you're now diabetic. Here, take these 7 pills. Yeah.
And then when they come back, when they come back in a diabetic coma, you go, that's what we were looking for. Now your glucose is nice and low.
We joke about this, but
no, I know.
You know, back when I started practice, every patient got an aspirin, a statin, an ACE, and metformin on their first visit. Mm-hmm. That was what you're supposed to do. Yeah, and we wondered why the quality of life was rated as quite low with aggressive management.
Yeah, exactly.
So, no, it's not pleasant. So, I mean, we've talked ad nauseum about targets and all that stuff. But these are interesting trials, and one thing for sure, James, is if you think about all of the other drugs, at least now we are getting hard outcome clinical trials from these surrogate marker interventions.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and you know, I'm impressed that these studies are being done, they're being published and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, these are multi-million dollar trials. They're really, I mean, 17,000 people and things like that. These are difficult trials to do. They're important to do. Now they were, and I mean, I don't mean this in the way it's going to sound, but they were forced to do this by the FDA. But I think the companies, I think people want, you know, everybody wants these studies done. So I think it's great.
And it's important to just remember what they're being forced to do, right? Like, they're being forced to do these studies, but the goal of these studies is quite different. They have to prove that they're not worse than placebo.
Yeah.
And so they have to, that's what they're after. That's the FDA has mandated that for new diabetes drugs coming to market, you have to plan clinical trials demonstrating that your intervention is not worse than doing nothing. So you're at least equivalent to nothing.
Placebo, yeah. And you know, to be positive, these are showing improvements in some outcomes.
Yes.
And again, we're still talking about one in, you know, at most sometimes 50 and maybe one in 100, you know, sort of for the benefit. But again, it's over and over 2 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're small, mm-hmm. but again, better than sulfonylureas.
Better than
so, and maybe the glitazones. Yeah. Certainly Rosie had some questions about increased harm.
So do you have a bottom line, Mike?
I have a bottom line. These drugs kind of work.
I don't think
you can say. So canagliflozin also works for renal impairment. And it should, if I had patients on with renal impairment, it would be something that I would think about sooner. And they needed treatment for their A1C and all of that kind of thing. I would be thinking about it because I'd want to reduce those outcomes for them, because it reduces renal outcomes and some cardiovascular outcomes. So I think it's become certainly higher on the list of diabetes drugs. So that I think is an important finding. And there are some others, like dabigatran heart failure stuff. I found that quite interesting because it's a little bit out of left field, but does make sense.
Yeah.
They basically work a little bit, which is more than you can say for a lot of our interventions. Exactly.
No, that's great. So that was sort of just, as we said, the diabetes roundup of the ones, and these have all been published just this year. So that's, we're not dredging studies from years ago. This is some of the new stuff that's come out. So I think anything else, Mike? I mean, we've got our course coming up in the end of April here in Vancouver, and we're just about to finalize all the speakers and all that coming up. So we'd love it if you could attend that, and keep checking out all of the guidelines that we're writing in Canadian Family Practice. Go to the Therapeutics Education website, see all the stuff that we're doing there, and also the peer group is publishing stuff on all sorts of stuff all the time. We got a really good group now.
Systematic review. We're
putting out stuff. And
we're going to have a great review of the next stage in pain management, which is osteoarthritis. So we're going to have something on that coming out in March. And yeah, so very positive stuff, which I think you'll find quite helpful.
Yeah, great. Excellent. Okay, so I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.